I'm Anna Genevieve Winham, and you're listening to the Passengers Preview Cast. I'm Anna Genevieve Winham, Editor-in-Chief of Passengers Journal, where our mission is to publish compelling art that is necessary rather than desired. You're listening to the Passengers Preview Cast for Volume 2, Issue 7, where our editors get to share what they love about a few pieces forthcoming in our next issue. Today, I'm joined by our audio editor, Charles Fleming. Say hello, Charles.
Hello, Anna. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for joining me. Very excited to have this audio component becoming an integral part of Passengers Journal, which
Same.
We'll get to talk about a little bit more later. So on the show today, our very first preview cast, we're going to get a chance later on to talk with our three department heads, visual art, poetry, and prose. But first, I'm going to give you just a few little updates on what's going on with Passengers, and then Charles is going to get to talk to you a little bit every once in a while, too.
Yes, I'm excited.
So the first thing that I want to talk about, and Charles, feel free to jump in if you have things to say on this topic, too, is okay. That Passengers has recently switched from a monthly publication to a quarterly publication. And we made this move for a few reasons that we're really excited about. Primarily because our mission is publishing work that is necessary. That's kind of our through line in everything where we're reading and we're thinking, okay, do we need to publish this? You know, this is a really nice story. This is a really nice poem. Is it necessary to publish this?
Mm-hmm.
And so as we were thinking more about this mission, as I was becoming the editor-in-chief and I was talking with our new prose editor, Haley Davis, we were realizing part of what we think is necessary is publishing people and publishing stories that have been marginalized in some way, people who've been kind of pushed to the edges, maybe haven't had access to academia or an MFA program or extensive editing services in the past, all things that kind of require some level of privilege to access, that might prevent a really necessary piece of work or a story from being published. So we wanted to create a little bit more space to spend more time with the pieces, and in some cases, if a piece is truly phenomenal, really catches us kind of off guard, knocks the breath out of us, but needs maybe just a couple of tweaks or a couple of changes, or the ending just didn't quite, you know, hit us in the same way as the rest of the piece, we wanted to be able to work with authors and give a little bit of editorial feedback or guidance on how to really take that piece from 99.999 to 100% and publish it. So that's kind of the main reason that we thought the move to quarterly would really work well.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I think that's really, really important in keeping with the mission. And, you know, for so many people, that mission statement is a very important, you know, component of what makes Passengers special. And I mean, that's certainly something that drew me to the journal when I first discovered it. And I think that it's really important that we not just talk the talk, you know, that we not just say that we're interested in pieces that are necessary, that we also are willing to walk the walk in a very cliche way of saying that we're also willing to help people who might need some help, you know, polishing or, you know, adding that last bit of flair to the ending or whatever, but they have something to say that really deserves to be heard, deserves to be read. And that's what we're all about. And I think it's a really valuable contribution to the whole literary community and to our world in general. Just kind of blowing it up for a second. but definitely I think that was our main reason for moving to quarterly. But I can certainly talk about my personal favorite thing about moving to quarterly if you'd like. Sure. This audio department that we've started at Passengers was really sort of the brainchild of Alex Lopez, mm-hmm. who was a former prose reader with us, and we're hoping that he is able to come back soon and do some more work with us. And so he and our prose editor, Haley Davis, really kind of got the idea off the ground. So this tree that is growing was born of a seed that Alex planted, I guess, and that Haley planted. Alex had to take a step back, which is fine. You know, people get busy. And I'll probably be busy in the next 6 months. Who knows? But when you and I, Anna, first talked about me possibly coming on as the audio editor, one of my big asks, or, you know, one of my big qualifications for kind of taking the role was that we would blow up this department and make it something that was a fully integrated, you know, feature mm-hmm. of the journal that was, you know, maybe not as important as the literature, but up there, you know, in importance. You know, mm-hmm. I don't want it to be kind of an afterthought. Like, I want it to be really, really great. And so one of the big struggles with having a really fully functional, fully integrated audio department was the month-to-month schedule that we were on.
Yeah.
The kind of grueling reading schedule and publishing schedule just didn't allow enough lead time for great audio components to be produced. So one of my big requests of you was, hey, look, you know, like, I'm willing to do this. I want to do this. But we have to have all of our audio content ready to go day one when the issue launches. And that means that my audio people will need more lead time. Mm-hmm. And I kind of saw, you know, light bulbs going off on your head, and you're thinking, well, I'm already, you know, like, I could just imagine what you're thinking. I really want to do this quarterly move anyway. Here's another reason to do it. Mm-hmm. So that was, for me, that was very, very important. And that the quarterly move to publishing every 3 months rather than every month gives us that space to have a fully functional, you know, fully integrated audio component, where hopefully with this next issue, it's my goal. And I think that we'll probably get there, or we'll get very, very close to having every single piece that we published being narrated mm-hmm. or being voiced by someone who has a passion for that piece, who has read that piece and actually actively selected that piece mm-hmm. To read themselves. It has, you know, really allowed for us to have that space and that time to produce that component. That's also, you know, given us the space and time to produce these podcasts, which I think are going to be really interesting and will kind of help our readership stay involved with the journal in between these longer sort of droughts between issues, but we'll have other content coming out. Right. Mm. So I'm super excited for the quarterly move. I feel kind of bad for our readers that they have to wait longer to get the content, but you know, they will see September 1st.
We'll be releasing some featured works every now and then, before right. the issues are released, just to tease you.
Yeah. And, you know, I really think that September 1st, when they see this first big drop of this first Passengers Quarterly mm-hmm. issue with fully, fully integrated audio components, I think that they're going to be kind of blown away with what we've been able to curate in the extra 2 months in between issues.
So I have to say, my other motivation for switching to quarterly is just the very first issue of Passengers was 50 contributors. And I just remember reading it and feeling like every single piece, I was just getting slapped in the face with some intense, dark, raw art. And I was thinking to myself, how are there 50 pieces like this? Like, it was really a phenomenon to read. And I just want to give that kind of wild reading experience to as many people as possible by moving back to quarterly. And then the other thing that I definitely want to make sure we talk about is you will be turning this into an event cast, I believe, but it really hit home for me the power of integrating audio into the journal, particularly because we are a digital journal, right? So we should be taking advantage of possibilities that being digital rather than being print affords. And one of those is audio. And it was so fantastic to hear your voice actors talking with our authors about what that collaborative experience was like to kind of create layers of art. And another thing to mention is the accessibility component of having the issue be fully voiced. Sure. There are, of course, screen readers for people who don't have good vision to hear a story, but having it read by a voice actor lends it that artistry that is missing from a screen reader, can allow people who, you know, are doing other things at the same time to be listening to a story. You know, it has whole ramifications that I'm very excited about.
So thanks for bringing that up, but that's, you know, a huge reason why I became really passionate about this really quickly is, you know, when I think about accessibility, of course, our obvious, you know, first thought is for people who are differently abled, who need voice to be able to experience the art. But for me, that really, like, you know, you mentioned privilege earlier, and there's a lot of privilege involved in being able to sit down and read for an hour a day. You know, some of us don't think of that, you know, but not everybody, you know, has that hour a day to drink their coffee and leisurely read, you know? But I believe really passionately that human beings need stories, and that it's cathartic to hear stories, that it relieves stress and that it enhances our life in so many ways. And so to be able to experience literature and stories from other people without having to necessarily sit down for that whole hour and read. I mean, just looking at what we're about to publish, we're about to drop something like 150 pages of literature, which is really, really great. But for somebody to read that might take 3 months, you know, for someone really, really intentionally sitting down for 1 hour a day to take in what we're putting out. But for me, that's really a big piece of the reason why I'm so passionate about the audio project, is because it's not just about differently abled people, although it obviously is about them to some extent, but it's much more about giving people the chance to experience this catharsis who otherwise wouldn't be able to because they don't have the time, because they're too busy, because they have children, because whatever, you know, because life is hard and because it's hard to sit down and read sometimes.
And it's nice to hear a human voice, I think, especially this past year, so many people have been living in isolation that it's nice to reach out across the void in that way as well. I think, without further ado, we're going to switch over to a kind of storytelling that you and I are not as familiar with, Charles.
I'm very excited for this. This is like a free class for
me. Right. So the first person that we're going to welcome, I am super excited to welcome. It's Lauren Vyar, our visual arts editor. And the reason that I'm so excited to welcome her to the show is that both Charles and I are really words people. Lauren's totally our expert on the visual art, so we might be a little bit quieter than we would otherwise be. But Lauren, take it away.
All right. So the first piece that I would kind of like to preview for our preview cast is In the Town of Diners and Pomegranates by Yarden Stefani. So I think this piece is really interesting because it shows this really great abstraction, this really beautifully chosen color palette. And I think everything is so fragmented in the piece, but also it all just fits together so nicely. And I thought it was really interesting that a pomegranate, something so simple, is in the center while everything around it is so chaotic and bustling and bright and colorful. And so I think it really takes the viewer and allows them to really focus on this pomegranate, something that's so daily and so simple and something that we wouldn't even really think about, despite all the chaos that's happening around it. And so I just thought it was super special and intriguing in that way. When I look at pieces, I really like pieces that kind of stop and make me think and allow me to look and engage for quite a while. And this piece definitely did that for me.
I feel like pomegranates are also so laden with symbolism and like mythology especially. How would you think about that tying into this piece, Lauren?
Absolutely. I kind of thought about that as well and thinking about, you know, the myth of Hades and Persephone. And I think it's super interesting that the pomegranate almost has this like flame-like mark off the top, and so I kind of was wondering if the artist meant anything by that or if that was a possible tie. So yeah, I was definitely thinking about the symbolism of the pomegranate as well, and its connection to not only like Persephone and Hades, but, and I know in Italian Renaissance art, it also has a symbolism connected to Aphrodite and connected to love. So I think that symbolism is also super interesting to think about in this piece as well, when you have something so laden with symbolism connected to love, because, you know, Persephone and Hades were technically in love, and you have Aphrodite and the Italian Renaissance and the symbolism that that carries and the chaos that surrounds it. So I think it's super interesting to think about it in that way as well.
That's super cool. I'm totally just going to school right now. I don't have much to add. Go ahead, Anna.
Well, so another thing that I, a question to put to the expert is, so obviously you have these kind of ancient Greek myths. The Renaissance is obviously really interested in ancient Rome and ancient Greece, but this looks to my layperson's eye like, you know, cubist, which is a modernist reinterpretation. What's your thought on, I don't know how that's situated, particularly now, like 100 or so years after the genesis of cubism?
I think it's super interesting, and I'll talk about this a little bit later with one of the other pieces that we're going to talk about, but I find it really interesting that these movements, especially these really abstractionist movements, like in the early 1920s, such as cubism and some color field, I've noticed. I've gotten a lot of like color field submissions, or even like collage, which is associated with the Dadaist movement in the early 20s. I think it's super interesting that I've seen an uptick in this and their association with like making sense out of tragedy, or just kind of emphasizing that like tragedy, like, reassures everybody that like nothing makes sense, you know, this correlation with like these movements and World War One, and then I've been seeing this uptick in submissions of those kind of genres, or like recalls of those genres in correlation to the COVID-19 pandemic. So I think that's, I'll elaborate that a little bit on that a little bit later, but I think it's super interesting to see that correlation. So I definitely like detect some like cubist like vibes from this work, if you will. That's kind of the first thing that I thought of. The cubist artists were not necessarily my favorite as people, but the art was certainly super revolutionary in the way that it abstracted everything, and really questioned how people view art and how people just look at objects in general. And so I think that it's a really interesting thing to think about and with this work.
Super cool. I'm intrigued about what piece you're going to talk about next.
So next I would really love to talk about Belladonna's by Perrin Aptola, which is really this collage that just so screams Dadaist movement to me. And especially the words that surround the collage figure, such as like young communist and the burdens of marriage. And it just like screamed Dada to me. And Dada's always been a really interesting and like complex movement to study, because the meaning of Dada, the reason it's called that movement, is because it just doesn't mean anything. Like, it's just a word that has no actual meaning, and it means like several different things in other languages. And it really was a reaction to World War One. And so, like I mentioned before, I think it's really interesting to see an uptick in collages. I've gotten so many submissions of collages, and how that kind of correlates with the COVID-19 pandemic and this idea that like tragedy, I think, really, and especially like global tragedy and global issues that everyone can relate to, really affirm that like nothing that we do as humans like really makes any sense, and the world doesn't make sense. And when you have like global tragedies like this, it really just like, it hits you that, you know, everything is just so like turned on its head. And it's super interesting to see collage as a reaction to like the COVID-19 pandemic and that correlation with Dada and World War One. So yeah, I mean, this is very like Hannah Hawke-ish to me, and just screams Dada. And so I don't know. I think that's just a super interesting thing to think about in this time period.
It's really interesting to me that you mentioned, you know, the kind of movements and stuff that happen around, you know, kind of large global upheavals. I mean, you know, coming from kind of a literary perspective, obviously we've had huge you know, moments of literary innovation around war and, you know, general catastrophe. And I mean, you know, right now, I guess we're in several different kinds of wars and, you know, from a social perspective and of course this, you know, COVID pandemic and everything, metaphorical wars, I guess you could say. And for some people, probably not so metaphorical. But it's really interesting that you talk about how this sort of chaos and upheaval in the world gets reflected so immediately within the art that's being produced. That's a really interesting point that I hadn't thought of at all. And that's my contribution. It's just, wow, that's a really interesting point.
It kind of makes me want to compare the submissions that we're getting in prose and poetry, as reactions to the pandemic, versus visual art, but I guess I'll bring that up with those editors. Mm-hmm. The last piece that you have, Lauren, seems really different from these two.
It is super different from the two other pieces that we've talked about. Firstly, and you know, foremost, it is a photograph by Lana Eileen. Right now, it's titled Photo 3, and I was just super enraptured by this photograph from the first time I laid my eyes on it, because there's such a mysterious feeling you get from it, and so much so that it's almost magical. I think it does a really beautiful job of capturing what seems to me to be kind of like an intimate moment of release and freedom, but also captures this mystery, because why does this woman, you know, have the flowers? What's the bird in the photograph? Because you can't really tell. Is it a dove? Is it a hawk? Is it an owl? Like, who knows? Mm-hmm. And so I really think the mystery of the photograph allows the viewer to sit there and ponder it. And I think that is so beautifully engaging. And I think that's what makes pieces, to me at least, stand out, when you can capture a viewer and like let them sit there or stand there for 20 minutes wondering like what is going on. And I really think that this image does that, and I think the quality of the black and white film adds this like mystery, because you don't know what time it's in. Is this from the past? Is this a moment happening currently in the present? I just think it's so beautifully mysterious and enrapturing, and I fell in love with it as soon as I saw it.
I think there's also kind of a moment of play, because it is a photograph, and it seems magical. There's this kind of tension between how much of reality we believe is real and how much we think is created. Where if it were a painting, you would know, you know, it's a creation, whereas you have to know that it's real in some sense because it's a photograph.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think photographs, you know, taken in this day and age, I think there's still a lot of mystery, you know, there as well, because things can be added and things can be taken away, and effects can be added, and you know, you have things like position and light and things that can be really altered, you know, in the editing process, which I'm not really sure if that even happened in this photograph. To me, it just seems like a piece of black and white film, and that's kind of hard to manipulate. However, in this day and age, you never really know. So I think the mystery of it all is just what's extremely intriguing and beautiful to me. I'm in love with it. It's like a puzzle. I really want to figure it out. But part of me kind of doesn't, because I think it would ruin it. So, I think it's just so great, so awesome. It's a fantastic piece. I think it's really interesting that the whole submission that Lana submitted is titled The Language of Water in this collection, and I think now that I'm like looking at it more and I'm thinking about it, I kind of correlate like the woman having this moment of like freedom and release to like the water that she's in, and how water, you know, is symbols for, you know, freedom and power, and how empowering that really is.
All right, well, all I'd say is if you actually want to see these pieces that Lauren is talking about, we will be launching our first quarterly issue September 1st. So look out for those, and look out for these images to see what Lauren was talking
about.
Thank
you guys so much for having me. I loved getting to nerd out a little bit with y'all.
Thank you, Lauren. It was a pleasure.
Lauren. right. And next up, I am very excited to invite our new assistant poetry editor, Andrea Chplinsky.
Yay, congratulations.
Yeah, that's actually a new role, but I'm sure she is up to the task.
I think so.
The first piece that Andrea is going to talk about, and give us a little preview of, is called Post-Typhoon Prayers by Tara Tulshian. Take it away, Andrea.
Hi, guys. Well, thank you for having me and for the fancy new title that I really hope I live up to. Thank you for the vote of confidence. It really means a lot. Post-Typhoon Prayers is actually a new selection, part of our last batch of reading that we just finished doing for the month. And I was really impressed with Tara's entire submission. All of her poems are very infused with a lot of tradition and with a lot of rituals that really create a sense of place and a sense of a community that, while it might be foreign to the reader, it is very well described and we do feel connected. And Post-Typhoon Prayers was one of my favorite poems in her five-poem submission. And it kicks off, you know, every reader has their own style of figuring out what they like. I really love a strong opening. Mm. So with this poem, split a chicken intestine along the grain of where the hen was sliced skin to bone along the grain of hunger. Mm. That is such a powerful three-line intro into what we're about to witness. And it sort of feels like it starts off as a recipe, as something about cooking, but then it just continues into describing this community. And it's a very visual, a very image-rich poem that, instead of specifically saying what this community looks like, it just gives little bits of fabric that create the entire tapestry by the end of the poem. And the ending, what a surprise, what a punch. At the end, we are exposed to what this poem really is about. And it's a poem about loss within this community and about grief at the level of community for the loss of one of its young members. So from beginning to end, I was with this poem. It really had me. And I love a surprise. I love a strong intro. I love a surprise at the end. I love great images. This poem really has it all. And I think it's very illustrative of what Passengers is looking for in a submission and what our readers will gravitate towards when they're going through submissions.
Yeah, I agree. This is definitely really very much a Passenger's poem in a lot of ways. But there are also lots of really great line breaks in here. I've had some workshops with Eduardo Corral, who's, I think, a modern master of line breaks. And what he talks about a lot in workshops is how a great line of poetry is interesting on its own. If you separate it out from the other lines around it, it forms its own unit of interesting linguistic phrase without any context around it. And there are several lines in here. I don't want to spoil them per se, because they should really be read, I think. They should be read within the context of the whole poem, obviously. But this this poet, particularly for being so young, has done a really excellent job with, I see four or five line breaks in here that are very instructive and create these very interesting units of linguistic phrasing that I think are super cool. Okay, so I'm going to read one because I think it's so interesting on its own. Only vinegar and rinse, a brown which we seem. Just by itself, it's a fascinating unit of poetry without the rest of it. That's one that really stuck out to me as a super interesting line and a very instructive line break.
Yeah, I also love that line. And not just because I love to cook, but also because it really reminded me of how my grandparents, my grandmothers, would dress a chicken. I grew up on a farm and we would raise and slaughter our own chickens, and not only, but this vinegar rinse is a thing. It's you vinegar rinse, especially if you cut through an intestine, to make sure that there's no, like, none of that nastiness and there's no funk that goes inside the meat of the chicken. And that's something that I've been living in the United States for 18 years, and I don't know that any of my circle of friends would know about that. Unless they lived on a farm. I don't know. Maybe farm life is indeed closer to what I've experienced. And so for me, it was a great connection. It was, it sort of awakened a sense of empathy in me, because I recognized that ritual. I connected with it. And even though it's not a part of my life anymore, it really brought back so many emotions. And that's, it's a brilliant thing to do. She's from a completely different country with a completely different culture, but there are these little things that just globally connect us. And it's so wonderful to see that expressed in poetry. I mean, this is what poetry is supposed to do. Well done.
It makes it very rooted. If you're ready, I want to ask about the next poem that you're going to talk about, Andrea. Speaking of universal themes and details, this is a very short piece, if you want to introduce it.
So the next piece I wanted to talk about is Smoke of an Old War by Christine Elizabeth Ham. It's a really short poem. It's only 4 lines. And you wouldn't believe the kind of impact this poem manages in those 4 lines. It's for such a short space. And this is the challenge with short poems. Every word it should pack a punch. And this poem doesn't overdo it. It's a very show, don't tell approach that it takes. And it's really well executed. And it's, speaking of the global nature of poems, this poem taps into current conflict and war scenarios without being outraged, without being righteous, without providing any sort of moral framework for it, which I think is really impressive. And the thing that really stands out the most is the show don't tell approach. And it just leaves the reader after those 4 lines exhausted and just really emotionally spent. I feel like I really want to read this poem, but I don't want to ruin it for everybody.
We could read it so quickly, but let's save it. We are going to have, a reading from Lori Dorfman on this poem. She has a really interesting, haunting voice, and she's going to do it great justice.
That's going to be perfect.
Yeah, it's such a great poem, and it's really hard, just because it's only 4 lines, it's really hard to not read it. But it's honestly, can I just say how it starts? It starts off with, it is this. It's fucking brilliant. I'm sorry, Kurt.
you can do that. It's okay.
But I am so happy to have it in Passengers.
Yeah, I agree. There's something really special about it. When I first saw it, it jumps off the page because of its smallness. But you're so right. And from kind of like an academic perspective, it's very much a classic imagist poem from Ezra Pound, Hilda Doolittle, from their school of thought, which is you just present images, basically. No wasted words, just images. No agenda, per se, which I love. And kind of like you got to, Andrea, there's several moments in this poem that are, I guess, sort of evoked. And I love that it ends on this sort of very evocative moment of almost hope, or at least that's how I interpret it, is this very brief reprieve at the end of this very short poem that all kind of hinges on one word. I'll let our readers read it or the listeners read it and guess at what that word is that I think it really hinges on. But yeah, and then like I think that it's also too that it's almost flirting with haiku, right? It's not haiku, but almost, like, you know, close enough in a lot of ways. Yeah, it's a really wonderful piece. We're very proud to have it.
I mean, honestly, I love that it's not a haiku. I sort of think a lot of people try to fit their work inside a particular form, and it hurts what they're trying to say. more often than not. So unless you're really skilled and have a lot of experience with writing haiku or sonnets or whatever the form is, just try to say what your poem wants to say instead of counting syllables and trying to fit the form. And this is why, like you said, it's almost haiku and it works so well that it's not.
Mm-hmm. I want to move us along to the last piece that you're going to talk about, Andrea. And I was thinking about it just now. I see kind of a through line in the pieces that you've chosen to talk about on this preview cast, which is they all have this kind of global rootedness, like a specificity that also manages to be, as you say, like the global power of poetry. So please go ahead, take it away with this last poem.
So yeah, our last poem is actually very dear to me for a lot of reasons. Love Baba by Bita Shakuri. So it's, again, I love a great intro. I love a good opening, and she makes great use of imagery. And this is a poem about, it's a bittersweet theme of decay within family relationships, which is something that I guess everybody could somehow have empathy for or connect with. And her intro of they make the screen smell like rice fields. There's a little line in there, speaking of emails. It's very evocative. It's very, and it's not that it necessarily brings to mind rice field smells, because I've never smelled rice fields, but just the idea of a smell from childhood is really well executed here. And it definitely kept me engaged. And my second favorite moment is her use of the word disgusting, which is a really general word. And I cringe at general words. And when I give feedback to people, I always advise to use more specific words. But honestly, I think it works so well for her. I really wanted to hate on it, but there's no other way for that line to come together without the use of the word disgusting. So under any other circumstances, I would have asked for a better version of it, but this was a pleasant surprise that it worked. And like I said before, I love surprises. One of the main reasons I love this poem, beyond the fact that it's great, is the fact that we worked with Bita on revisions for it. So this is something that we do at Passengers. If we love the idea of a poem, the theme, the style, the voice, if something really grabs us, we offer free editorial revision. And we work with that person. We had a Zoom meeting with Bita, and then we emailed back and forth. And she was so quick, so receptive to the feedback, and absolutely understood how to make those little changes that really polished the poem technically and made it so that it was absolutely perfect. By the time we emailed only twice, so after the second email, the entire poem was just like little technical details that needed a little bit of polishing, and she was so great, so quick, so on it. I loved working with her, so now she's like part of the family. So yeah, for anyone who's afraid of submitting on, for technical reasons, don't be afraid. If you have something to say, and if you say it genuinely and openly, and you have a great voice that we can hear, we're here to hear it. And we're more than happy to offer revision support and you know, whatever we can do to get that voice out there.
Now we will hear a special audio preview of Angelica Allen's reading of Love, Baba, written by Bita Shakuri. Charles, do you have a few words to say about this wonderful narrator, Angelica?
Yes, we are incredibly lucky to have Angelica. She came to us through our application, which is available on our website on the staff page. And she's first off just a wonderful person. Her qualifications are really something. She actually worked in the Obama West Wing for 2 years, which is super fascinating. But more impressive to me is, as an aspiring teacher, is her resume as a teacher. She's taught at university level, high school level, and she taught at San Quentin State Prison. Which is very, very cool to me. So we're very lucky to have her because of her credentials, but we're also very lucky to have her because she is able to speak in Farsi, which is a great asset for us. And something that we're really, really looking for are people who specialize or who are able to handle snippets of other languages, various languages. We actually have quite a big staff now that can do quite a bit. We have people who are capable of Yiddish and Hebrew, French, Spanish, Portuguese, and then various dialects in between there. We have narrators from all over the world, which is great. We have people in New Zealand, India, Canada, all over the U.S. So we really need people who are able to specialize and give us the gift of their ability to speak in other languages. And so we're super lucky to have Angelica, who can handle Farsi for us. This poem does contain some elements of Farsi. So without further ado, this is Angelica Allen's wonderful reading of Love Baba by Bita Shikori.
I'm Angelica Allen. For Volume 2, Issue 7 of Passengers, I'm reading a poem written by Bita Shikori entitled Love Baba. His German's getting worse. It falls apart in his emails. They make the screens smell like rice fields and haven't changed since he took the Jode Charus back home. He tells me about his vegetable garden and his health and the Islamic Republic. Say hi to your brother for me, carries each message on its back. Among the wilting sentences, they're the few words he's never misspelled. He's my pen pal, 77, and used to tear my earlobes off if I wasn't quiet when he went to lie down in the afternoons. When he sent me pistachios, my friends and I called it child support between fits of laughter. Maman holds back tears and is so proud when I visit him. It makes me feel disgusting, but someone has to, and my brother stopped responding to him years ago. Afterwards, her face is different. She says she doesn't want to hear about it. Maybe no one will congratulate you for being a good child when you're 24. I try not to cry in the car. Who am I going to tell that he always speaks Farsi when he first sees me?
Wow, what a phenomenal poem. What a beautiful reading that was.
Indeed.
So thank you. Thank you both to Bita Shikori and Angelica Allen for collaborating on that really cool piece of art together. Now, moving on, we're going to have a little chat with our prose editor, Hayley Davis.
Thanks, Anna. So I'm really excited about doing this. And the first piece that I wanted to speak about is Flotsam by Mike Kiggins. I think there's a couple of reasons I wanted to speak about this one, really. I think it's a really good example of what we do at Passengers, what we're striving to do. So Mike sent in Flotsam. And we all really loved it. All of the readers loved it. But we thought that it wasn't quite there yet. So we went back to him and said, would you work with us? Right? Will you work with us, make some edits, and then we will publish? And he was really open to that. And I just really enjoyed the finished product. So it's a really interesting premise. And I think that's what really drew me to the story initially. You know, it's this girl who's in hospital, she's at this appointment, but then there's this other sort of situation with her mother. We don't know quite what's going on there. And the descriptions are really lovely. There's a part where the protagonist is asked, you know, what a needle being dragged along her foot felt like. And she responds that it feels like a cactus, like cactus needles dripped in nitrogen. Just some really lovely sort of imagery there. But I think also what this piece does really well is it uses a lot of sort of medicalized jargon. Like there's some really sort of technical descriptions of illnesses and treatments. And that can be really sort of difficult ground to tread. But I think they do this really well, you know. And I think it plays against this sort of really lovely imagery. And then you sort of come back to this really sort of sterile, stark medical jargon. And I really liked that interplay. And another thing about this piece is that I like to be surprised in stories. And I felt like this kind of, there was some ambiguity. I'm not going to give any spoilers, but, you know, we start in this one place where you think it's about kind of this girl, you know, and her hospital appointment. And then it kind of veers off into something that you're not quite sure what's going on there.
Really goes
Yes,
and I find that really interesting. And I love a story that kind of, I think, wait, hang on, what was this? You know, but in a way that's kind of challenges you rather than you just think, I have no idea what's going on here. They did it in a way that was really interesting and sort of drove you right to the end of the piece. So I'm really, really glad that we've got to publish this one.
Hayley, can I ask you a quick question?
Sure.
What about it made you think, you know, even if there are a few tweaks that need to be made, we really want to publish this one? Kind of what was the core that drove you on that decision?
I think there were a couple of things. So I thought the premise was interesting, right? So it was this, I think when I got to sort of the midway point. Okay, so what kept me reading initially was that I thought that the writing was good and I liked the description. So that kept me reading. Hmm. And then when we got to this sort of midway point where there was some ambiguity about what was going on, I was like, huh, okay, I like this. I like to be surprised. I like to be challenged as a reader. And I thought the things that needed to be or could be fixed to improve it were worthwhile. And I thought that it was something that we should take the time to finesse, I guess, essentially. I think it was a combination of those things that made me think, okay, yeah, let's go back. Because I just thought it was a worthwhile story to print. And I didn't want us to lose that just because there was something that wasn't quite right. Yeah.
And then, I mean, there's this really interesting tense shift that happens in it. Like, I'm not going to spoil it per se, but a lot of times writers try to employ tense shifts in ways that are really kind of awkward and really don't work. But for me, that was the most interesting section of the story, I thought. That was really well done. And particularly because, it, you know, kind of like you said, Hayley, like it just comes out of nowhere. And then it sort of slaps you with this very, you know, very, you know, outside the box tense shift that is sort of jarring. But at Passengers, we kind of like jarring if it's good jarring. Yeah. You know, we enjoy that. And yeah, so that was for me kind of the most fascinating sort of craft aspect of the story. And I'm really happy that you all and the prose team worked together to kind of bring it out, because I think it really does deserve a spot. It's a great story.
Yeah. So I guess I'll go on to my next piece, my next submission. We have Spell by Casey Vance. And I didn't realize that I'd picked two that are sort of to do with sort of a medical environment.
I don't know what shocking in this climate that
I didn't know. Yeah. I was like, that would be pertinent.
We're on a theme today.
Yeah. But maybe that is, yeah, maybe it's a sign of the times, but actually this is, I guess, more about death than it is about, you know, the medical situation. And again, there's some use of medical sort of jargon and it's done really well again. And again, there were just some really, really lovely imagery. And I think the themes that are being touched upon here were done in a really clever way, right? So you've got death, you've got religion, you've got God, you've got all of these things sort of swirling around. And there was one part in particular that I thought was really clever. So there's a part where the author is talking about a cancer diagnosis and this feeling of being on the beach with her partner and it kind of washing over her, and there's all this imagery around waves and being on the beach and Florida, and it really made me think of you know that parable where, you know, there were two sets of footsteps in the sand and then there's only one footstep and then that's when God carried you. And I thought it was really clever because then later on there's this whole kind of you know, as I say, it's one of the themes, you know, sort of God and what comes afterwards and heaven and all those sort of things and near-death experiences. So I just thought that was a really clever part there where she kind of plays with all of those ideas in a few lines. I just thought it was really poignant, just really beautifully observed.
I loved how it gave you, as a reader, a very easy way into this very hard topic. So beginning with this kind of very colloquial, conversational, rhythmic section about spelling, it was once again a story with a turn or a surprise, and it used this almost like backbone to hinge all of the other pieces onto with this very kind of like easy way in with the spelling, where it went in a totally different direction but was still attached to that spine all the way.
And I mean, this one really speaks to the power of a great ending, I think. I mean, there's this last section at the end of the story that, I mean, there are some really great stories out there that really fall on their face, like in the last two or three paragraphs. You know,
I mean, it's so sad.
And, you know, we see lots of those, you know, I mean, it's so much is said about starting the story and like, you know, so much is said about having a really strong start that keeps people reading. And that's very, you know, that's obviously so important. But the ending is almost as important ultimately, you know,
and
I think that this one really sticks a really beautiful and sort of, just kind of like a hanging kind of melancholy ending in lots of ways, which I love. I mean, sometimes it's so funny in my poetry workshop, somebody just said the other night, you know, not every poem has to be a journey. Sometimes you can just let the wound hang. And let the wound sit open. And in some ways, I think that's kind of what happens here in this ending. I think it's really well done and really beautiful in a sort of tragic and philosophical way that I really love.
And also inescapable.
Yeah.
Like you kind of knew that this was the ending that was coming and you still can't do anything afterwards.
Yeah. Agreed. So Haley, you have one more for us, right?
I do. So the last one I wanted to speak about is The Challenger by R.F. Michalki. Another really great piece for lots of reasons. So it's a short piece. It's a piece of flash fiction. So you have to, you know, get straight in and pull us in and do a lot of work, you know, in, you know, fewer words. But really, from the get-go, right, they really managed to build this world of a specific time, and I guess in everyone's sort of youth, sort of childhood, sort of early teens, I'm guessing that's where the age range lies. And you know, although it's not, you know, completely, I mean, I never kind of smoked cigarettes outside an arcade, you know, but there was that they managed to kind of really conjure up a really specific sense of childhood and this kind of really lovely nostalgia that it brought up. You know, because although I haven't, you know, ever been, you know, smoking outside in an arcade, we all kind of recognise that moment in childhood where, you know, you all gather around to play, you know, Nintendo or watch someone do wheelies, you know, and there's that kind of moment of communion and anticipation, and they really captured that really well.
Yeah, I mean, this one really kind of brings up a lot of childhood memories for me. I mean, I'm just old enough to remember when arcades were big, but I'm not old enough to remember the first wave of big arcade games like Pac-Man and, you know, Asteroids is kind of the focus of this particular story. But when I was coming up, we had a local arcade and fighting games were the big thing, right? It was like Mortal Kombat and Street Fighter. You know, those kind of games were really, really popular when I was coming up. But I actually like remember people lining up, you know, putting their quarters in a line to kind of claim their next challenger spot or whatever. And so that was really, really interesting to me in general, because you're right, he does really paint that atmosphere of what the arcade was like when there was a great new game. And I remember that briefly. More interesting for me, you know, for this piece is like all the bizarre literary theory things we can do with it, like in terms of metaphor, you know, like what ways, you know, I mean, I don't want to get too, you know, academic per se here, but the whole idea of sort of chasing the high score, you know, in any kind of video game is a really interesting metaphor for capitalism and for, you know, economies in general. And that's, you know, kind of like I said, I'm taking this in a whole, you know, lit theory. Is that really their direction? But I think it's there if we want it to be there. And I think it really is an interesting metaphor, particularly when the main character in the story talks about going to sleep and seeing, you know, on the ceiling, like almost in like a it made me think of the, what's the Netflix show with the girl playing chess?
Queen's Gambit.
Yes, where she sees the chess pieces moving on the ceiling every night. That's that's what it kind of made me think of. And I don't know why I just recently watched that all in one day, sadly. That's what the pandemic has done for us. But yeah, but I really enjoyed this piece as someone who is old enough to remember arcades and a little bit of their heyday. But Anna, what did you think of this piece?
Well, I actually have a question for Haley that perhaps I'll give my opinion on first. So I was thinking about the form of flash fiction and why this piece particularly succeeds as a piece of flash. So I think one of the challenges that flash fiction sets up for itself is to create something that is powerful and moving, and has a narrative or plot or something happens, and like perhaps in a poem where you don't necessarily have to have something happen. But it has to do it so rapidly. And it's hard to leave an impression with so few words. Like that's kind of the challenge. And so my thought with this piece, The Challenger, is that it is so vibrant and creates a complex web of social relationships, vividly. Like, in that first paragraph, the phrases like his hips moving side to side with his long blonde hair swiping at the hot air, eyes focused in total command of asteroids, just kind of is a sentence that like leaps off the page, and you can see it, and you can imagine this kind of gaggle of boys playing and having interactions where you're on the cusp of childhood and adolescence, and it seems like, I don't know, full and vibrant and like it's going to burst off the page, and it's really quickly really powerful in that way. And the way that the piece ends by kind of leaving the actual world of the arcade and stepping out a little bit and positioning it as like an inner story, outer story, I think works really well, because you yourself as a reader of the piece are in a third, you know, piece of third remove. So you get to see how close you have been in the whole piece. You know, you began so close and you gradually drift further away. And I think it leaves you with this feeling of longing or nostalgia, or unfulfilled desire, because you were almost there, but not quite.
Yeah.
So I think that's why this really succeeds as flash. And why you maybe wouldn't want it to be, you know, it shouldn't be a longer story. It's perfect as a piece of flash fiction. So I was wondering, you know, if you have any thoughts on, and maybe this goes for other pieces of flash that could be in the issue or potential future contributors, you know, what about this piece really works as flash?
I guess so you know that thing where you find an old photo. So maybe it's one of when you're a teenager and it's with you and your friends out, or you find an own, whatever it is, right? And I can only explain it as a hurty feeling. It just brings something to your, like, you feel something in your gut. It's like a really, it's really sort of an indescribable thing, right? So it's just a really, it's a photo, and it has all of this. It conjures up so much, right? And I guess that's the kind of thing that you have to be aiming for with flash, right? You have this really small framework and you have to create an emotional punch.
That's a really interesting way to think of that, as like, as sort of like a vehicle for just evoking, you know. I think that's really fascinating.
It makes me think of that phrase, a photo is worth a thousand words or whatever, because a thousand words is about the flash length. And so you are trying to do actually literally what you said, Haley, and have the power of a photo in the thousand
because
words.
Because you're right there, right? You don't have to have all of this preamble with it. You know, you don't have all this preamble with a photo. You know, it's just immediately there, right? The world it's like a portal to a moment. Right? And I guess that is what you're aiming for with Flash. Right? You have to work quickly. You have to evoke something, whatever it is you're aiming for, very quickly. And I guess that would be my advice. To keep that in mind when you are writing Flash.
Well, Haley, thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Haley.
I've loved it. Thank you.
All right. So now we have another special audio preview from one of our narrators, Sam Mitchell. We're going to hear his reading of The Challenger by R.F. Michalki that will end on a bit of a cliffhanger, if I'm allowed to say that in advance. Charles, do you have a few words to say about this wonderful narrator, Sam Mitchell?
Sure. So Sam is just, in general, just a really cool dude. When we met for our kind of interview over Zoom, I usually expect them to take like 30 minutes and they ended up taking like an hour. He's somebody I would love to kind of get together with and have a beer with or something. He's really just a wonderful guy, and he was really eagle-eyed and spotted my Chuck Palahniuk collection behind me. So we digressed about that for like 10 minutes, because I'm just a big time disciple of Palahniuk. And apparently Sam is too. But Sam, is a graphic designer by trade. And so if someone needs some graphic design work done, feel free to find his website listed on our staff page of the journal. He's very, very good at that. And he's also a pretty seasoned writer as well. And so we are very, very lucky to have Sam. And he just did a great job with this reading. But the ending is a cliffhanger. There is more after where we're going to end this reading. So with that being said, without further ado, here's Sam Mitchell reading R.F. Michalki's The Challenger.
I'm Sam Mitchell. For Volume 2, Issue 7 of Passengers, I'm reading a piece of Flash fiction written by R.F. Michalki, entitled The Challenger. Mike is in the arcade. He's always there. There in the back through a narrow path of blade-thin black carpet, stomped threadbare, legs spread, one hand twitching on the joystick, the other blasting, his hips moving side to side, with his long blonde hair swiping at the hot air, eyes focused in total command of asteroids. I lock my bike on the rack. The arcade windows stand guard, dark and menacing and glowing, vibrating with neon buzz, a total high. I walk in, feeling red eyes and low light itching in cigarette haze. I walk the path, ignoring the turning heads. In my wake, dozens of dudes line up, pushing for a spot to see the action. On many of these machines, Mike and I held the top lines. I am Tor, and he is Mick. Topping out Asteroids is the most sought-after top line in the arcade, not because it is the best game in the house, but because it was the first machine that hooked us all, and we loved it. In the morning, we would sog through the tall Florida weeds on sides of roads for returnables to stack quarters. At dusk, we bounced and shifted, pounding buttons until each of us were pulled away for one reason or another. In the parking lot, we'd sit on the curb smoking fresh buds, and when short on cash, the butts we'd find in ashtrays, rinsing our mouths by downing Mountain Dew. Being on top is what it's all about. We stand on the edges, memorizing patterns, watching, whooping any new top. We live for top recognition. We talk smack, high-five each other, smile, and laugh. Our steaming, dilated eyes cut through the screen glow holographs blurring in the wafting smoke to pulverize, outrun, stomp, punch, shoot, stab, or crush. In bed each night, I would replay my tops on closed eyelids, my eyes moving in all directions. When I round the last machine, Mike is exactly where I knew he would be. He has already warmed up on Asteroids. Some dude in the back belches Mountain Dew fizz and says, "This is gonna be epic." As is our way, we flip for who goes first. One game each. High score wins. I lose the toss and go first. I work magic with the joystick, skittering back and forth, thrusting my hips in and out until I top even my last top by more than just a smidge. I turn and nod to the dudes who know they've seen a work of art. Mike stands from the challenger's stool and flashes a brand new shiny quarter before slapping it into the machine.
So, that's our first show. Thank you all for joining us for the preview cast. Thank you as well to our department editors, prose editor Haley Davis, assistant poetry editor Andrea Chaplinsky, and visual arts editor Lauren Vaya for joining us. A special thank you to Buku Brew for the music you heard on the show today. Their work is available across music platforms. Last, but certainly not least, thank you for joining me today, Charles, and for building our whole...
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Without you, there would be no preview cast at all. So thank you. please find the pieces featured here alongside many more when Volume 2, Issue 7 launches on the 1st of September at passengersjournal.com. After the new issue launches, join us for the next in our series of podcasts, the Passengers Prose Cast, where we will discuss what makes the prose published in Issue 2, Volume 7, both necessary and compelling. Are you interested in contributing to the journal or joining our team? Please find our open calls on Submittable and our staff application on the staff page of our website. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for all the latest Passengers news.